Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Wildlife Alliance's Nick Marks, Wildlife Rescue Director at the Phnom Tamau Wildlife Rescue Center in Cambodia, about his work rescuing wildlife from illegal trade. The Phnom Tamau Wildlife Rescue Center is situated less than an hour away from Cambodia's capital of Phnom Penh and is home to over 1,200 animals rescued from the illegal wildlife trade. Since 2001, the Cambodian government has cracked down on the illegal wildlife trade with the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team, an interagency wildlife crime investigation and counter-trafficking unit of the Forestry Administration and Royal Gendarmerie of Cambodia, operating with technical and financial support from Wildlife Alliance. Wildlife Alliance is a nonprofit organization based in Cambodia and Washington, D.C., that works directly with communities and governments to improve forest management and institute good governance to comprehensively address the devastation of ecosystems and combat the illegal wildlife trade. Much of what it does focuses on empowering local communities by promoting diversified agriculture, community-based ecotourism, and reforestation. To date, the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team has rescued more than 40,000 live wild animals, raided hundreds of restaurants, markets, and shops illegally selling wildlife, set up checkpoints on roads, and dramatically reduced wildlife crime in Cambodia. Whenever possible, live animals rescued by the team are released back into the wild. But when the rescued animals need medical attention or are too young for release into the wild, they are taken back to the Phnom Tamau Wildlife Rescue Center for care. Nick Marks serves as Wildlife Rescue Director at the center. He holds a master's degree in conservation biology and has more than 40 years of experience in animal care, especially with large wildlife. His animal experience includes large predators such as tigers, lions, cheetahs, and leopards, primates including orangutans and gibbons, elephants, and other mammals. He has worked in park management, wildlife conservation, and animal care in the United Kingdom, India, South Africa, and Southeast Asia. He advises the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team on dealing with human-animal conflicts and providing care for animals rescued from the illegal wildlife trade. He has lectured and published broadly on wildlife conservation and animal husbandry, and appeared on global television broadcasts on BBC, ABC News Nightline, CNN's Planet in Peril, and other global media outlets. When we spoke, I asked Nick to tell me what he does for Wildlife Alliance.
Basically, I'm in charge of the conservations or the rescues of wild animals. Basically, I kind of manage the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team, which is a group of military police and forestry officials that travel throughout the country, confiscating illegally traded wildlife from wildlife traders. Animals that they confiscate, we release if we can in the safe area. If we can't release them, then we take them to the Wildlife Rescue Centre, Phnom Tamau Wildlife Rescue Centre, which is about 40 kilometres outside Phnom Penh, and we care for them there.
How big of a problem is wildlife trade in Cambodia?
I feel that trade, tons and tons of wildlife crosses the border every year. My team does not deal with subsistence hunting, though perhaps this is where the problem starts a lot of the time. It's basically an urban force, so we go into the forest if we need to. If we hear some bears being kept secretly in the forest that we need to go and rescue, we go and do it. But largely, my team deals with wildlife traders that are based in cities or in towns, in villages. We receive information that there is wildlife being stored for sale, and we go and address the situation. We confiscate the wildlife, and the traders will be prosecuted. The Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team do not deal with the subsistence hunting. They deal with the traders. And it's trade that's driving species to extinction. It's it's consumption, I think largely in China and Vietnam, that most of our wildlife seems to cross the border into Vietnam. That, you know, it seems to be headed for Vietnam when we kind of do the bust. a lot of it, if it's on the road, comes across the border every month. And it's this, it's not, you know, poor families in the forest needing something to eat. The wildlife rapid rescue team is addressing wildlife traders. And like I said, tons of pangolins, tons of turtles, tons of macaques cross the border. It's a huge trade, and it's decimating wildlife in the forest.
Most of this is taking animals out of Cambodia and exporting them to Vietnam or elsewhere in Asia?
Yeah, that's correct. I don't say there's no consumption in Cambodia, but actually to eat, kill, capture wild animals in Cambodia now is illegal.
What's the role of Wildlife Alliance in implementing the law?
We and other conservation organizations are helping the Cambodian government implement this law. There's the Cambodian Forest Administration or the Ministry of the Environment and the NGOs that are helping implement the law protecting wildlife. It's illegal now, so many of the restaurants have stopped, not all of them by any means, but thanks to the Wildlife Rescue Team, many of the restaurants in Phnom Penh and Cambodia have stopped selling wildlife. And it's more underground now, so obviously it's more profitable for people, maybe to where they're going to fetch a higher price anyway, to sell their wares in Vietnam or China. So there's not huge consumption. It is kind of largely, yeah, animals leaving Cambodia to be used as medicine, used as taken as pets, or as food in other countries. It's more expensive in this country really now, certainly in the cities, to eat wildlife than it is to eat chicken or beef. So it's kind of a bit of a, more nowadays, more of a luxury item as it's becoming scarcer.
When was the law passed that made it illegal to kill and capture wildlife in Cambodia? And does that apply to all species or just listed species?
No, the law protecting wildlife applies to basically most species. There are some that it's not so illegal, more common species of turtle and things like that. But basically, it is pretty much across the board, and it's been in place for a long time. But we've worked with the government to upgrade the law on governing the protection of wildlife, so that now it's kind of been tightened up within the last couple of years. But it's implementation, so it's illegal, but it is the implementation. Like it's illegal in Vietnam, in many countries, it's illegal to hunt wildlife. But there's no one really, I think authorities don't consider it particularly important, so it's not implemented properly. And here we're trying to make it implement this law better.
What animals are we talking about? What types of species are traded?
Basically everything. Everything is eaten. Everything has some real or imagined medicinal value, and everything is traded, from elephants and tigers downwards. Everything's hunted, everything's captured, elephants and tigers down to birds, down to macaques, to monkeys, to pythons and cobras, everything, monitor lizards, everything you care to think of has either a food or a medicinal or a pet value. And as the bigger, more charismatic species have been basically decimated, of course, value is placed on other animals. For example, there are very few tigers left in Cambodia. There are small populations of elephants. But as these animals become, and obviously big cats are a huge financial value, dead, of course. But as these animals have disappeared, so greater value is put on things like turtles and for example, long-tailed macaques, a common species of primate, formerly a common species of primate. You find them everywhere. They've been captured now and used for experimental purposes in Vietnam, in the West, in America, and in Europe. And forests now are kind of almost bare of long-tailed macaques. It's formerly an extremely common primate that the world is using for its experimental research. Unfortunately, there's a legal trade in long-tailed macaques, but it's illegal to export wild caught animals. Of course, this is just like a smokescreen. Wild caught macaques are exported most regularly. Legally, really, the only animals that can be exported are captive born macaques, born in the macaque farms that are now springing up. But of course, this is just a smokescreen for what really goes on.
Is there a way to tell a captive bred from a wild-caught macaque?
Clearly, they should be, branded in some way, like a tattoo or a number placed on the macaque. But of course, that's easy to do, and most people don't bother anyway. I mean, it depends what you're going to use the macaque for. But if it's merely going to a restaurant to be eaten, there's going to be no evidence anyway. So, largely, authorities on borders don't really care too much anyway. Anyway, that's what we're trying to stop. We're trying to, you know, we have a new implementation this year, ASI and WEN. WEN stands for Wildlife Enforcement Network, which is now hopefully going to be operating better within Cambodia, in as much as the authorities in the regional countries, in the ASEAN countries, are cooperating together so that when animals leave Cambodia, for example, they are not home and dry. The trader is not home and dry. Authorities in Vietnam will be alerted that this car or this whatever it has been, happens to be, has crossed the border, and it can still be, and they can still be, the traders can still be arrested. So hopefully we will implement that properly this year. We've been going through the motions now, working with the government, getting all the bureaucracy sorted, and hopefully this year it'll be up and running and in full implementation within Cambodia. It's been going in Thailand for a couple of years now.
With great success.
Yes, huge. Previously it's a dash to the border. Our guys in pursuit of the traders, and if they cross the border, it's determined dry. Hopefully, they won't be a safe base for traders once this is up and running. And the Cambodian Forestry Administration is keen to, the government is keen to get this running smoothly and properly.
And it's in the Cambodian Forestry Administration where the law enforcement for wildlife and for the wildlife protection laws lies?
Largely, it's a bit of a grey area. The forestry law is there, but it's also that certain areas are protected by the Ministry of Environment. And there is slight conflict there, but largely.
Tell me about the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team. What is it and who's on it?
Basically, there are four forestry officials, 8 military police. There's one Cambodian civilian project manager and me. I really actually nowadays do very little. They are really, really good. They're very cool guys. They're fantastic with the animals that they rescue. They work extremely hard. They travel the whole country, so you can imagine, like 3 trucks and a car, and basically 12, 13 guys traveling throughout the country has a huge area to cover. I used to go with them quite a lot, but now if I'm needed, I'm there. If there's a problem, I help them sort it out. If there's a difficult animal, I'll be with them. But otherwise, my background is basically is wild animals. It's not police work.
What's the process for the team? How do they find out that there's an issue?
So different ways. We can get information from a member of the public. There is a wildlife hotline. If they see wildlife in markets, somewhere they shouldn't be. But largely, we have informants throughout the country that let us know what's going on. Here something's going on, come on, go out there and see what it is. In the different provinces, there's people that will contact us and let us know if there's a trade. There are known traders around the place, and we perhaps keep them under observation or word of mouth that there's something going on.
Is it mostly products or live animals?
It can be both. there's traders that have huge amounts of dead wildlife paraphernalia. And there's also a lot of live animals. I think in the time that the mobile unit has been, so-called, I don't know what you call that, the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team have been going. It's around 50,000-ish, give or take, 50,000 live animals that we've rescued.
Over what time period? It's been operating since 2001?
Around 10 years, around 10 years.
Wow.
I mean, so it's not all, it's not all elephants and tigers. Of course, there's a huge amount of small brown birds and pythons and cobras and turtles and lizards and things like that. But also a lot of bears, sun bears and Asiatic black bears. Huge amount of wildlife we rescue. And I don't need to say that the illegal wildlife trade is incredibly cruel. Just because these animals are alive don't think that people love them and care for them and look after them. Animals that are captured, for example, macaques, will be put in small bags, small sort of gauze bags, plastic type bags. They will probably not be fed or given water. They're used often, if they're transported in a car, they might be transported on ice because that keeps them quiet, so it doesn't alert authorities. And if they die, of course, it keeps their meat fresher. We receive animals with hideous wounds, which we will care for. We euthanize very, very little. It's kind of illegal here anyway, but everything gets a chance. Most things that we get survive once the Wildlife Act Rescue Team have rescued them. I've got a really good vet working with me now. He's a lovely guy, loves animals. He's desperate that everything survives. So we do really, really well. The Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team, these are military police. They will bottle feed if there's a baby animal in transit. They will bottle feed the baby bear or the baby deer or whatever it is until I get it, until they bring it to me. So they're gentle. They've been trained. We've trained them how to deal with animals. They know that there will be serious repercussions if they're not good with the animals, if the animals are not handled with consideration and with responsibility. And actually, once we rescue them, very little dies. So considering the trauma that these animals have been through, it's quite a record. And again, we've transformed the rescue centre just outside of Phnom Penh into, I reckon, must be probably the best government-run rescue centre in any developing country, or perhaps in any country. It's a great little place. Basic, it's forested, it's hot and dusty, but the animals thrive there.
Can you describe the facility? How big is it? What's it look like?
It's called Phnom Thamau Wildlife Rescue Center. Cambodians like to call it a Phnom Thamau Zoo because I think we in the West don't particularly like zoos anymore. They do have a very great purpose. Rescue centre has a greater connotation because the animals are helped, and possibly released again. So I like the term rescue centre. It's set in Phnom Thamau Wildlife Rapid Rescue Phnom Thamau Wildlife Rescue Centre is set in 2,300 hectares of forest. The actual area where we keep animals, rescued animals, is probably around 120 hectares or something like that. But then we release animals into the forest also. I mean, there's all sorts of animals we've released, from deer, sandbar deer, muntjac deer, primates, many, many birds, wild boar, jackal, leopard cats, all sorts we've released very successfully under a soft release program. The enclosures, they're not, magnificent architectural wonders. They're like cheap and cheerful, but they're big. The enclosures are big. They're fenced areas of forest. They're natural, and the animals do really well there. And we have a complete cross section of species, from elephants and tigers downwards. But the nice thing about what we do here is we deal with the illegal trade, but then the wildlife that we rescue is not forgotten or, as happens in some countries, merely recycled, being sold on by the officials that confiscate them. Here, we deal with the confiscation, we deal with the rescue, and then we deal with the animals that we rescue. So if we can release them again, we will. And in a safe area, or as safe an area as we can find, to give the animals a second chance. But if they're too young or too old or injured or tame or whatever, then we'll look after them. And we'll look after them for the rest of their lives. Nothing is turned away and everything gets a second chance. And it's a tribute to the Cambodian government that we have been able to work so well in implementing this initiative.
How many animals are there currently?
At Phnom Thamau Rescue Centre, there are around, it's always between 1,000 and 1,200 animals. It's around that number, depending on what we release. and what we get in, kind of thing. I mean, we do release a great deal. I mean, a lot of animals, you know, don't think it's all elephants and tigers. Like I say, it's lots of birds that later can be doves and that would otherwise be eaten, small birds that go as pets. We may get lots of baby parakeets or something in, which we'll raise. And I also have a little project down in the southwest of the country, a wildlife rehabilitation station, and we can take animals down there once they've reached a certain size, and we release them there, again, under a soft release program, so that when they go, we keep them for a long time in one area, and then when we can, in a cage, and then we open the door, once they're familiar with the surroundings, open the door, and continue to put food down for as long as it's needed. And it works really well. It's kind of benign. Nothing's thrown away. Everything gets a chance. You know, you've loved these animals and looked after them for so long. They're like, I guess, like you wouldn't throw your child out into the streets of Phnom Penh or wherever else. You make sure you have a good start. And that's what we try and do with the young animals or the animals that we release. We can't say everything survived, but like a good parent, we try and give it the best possible chance.
Do you monitor the released animals after they've left, or is there a way to monitor them?
Yeah, very good question. And of course, how do you know if you do your job properly if you don't monitor the animals that you release? And there are different ways of monitoring. Of course, there's the highly expensive radio monitoring. You tag your animal with a transmitter, and then you track his movements to make sure he's okay and he's surviving. And you can upgrade your own processes, your own rehabilitation processes, by the successes and failures of what you find out. And yes, I've done that with leopard cats. I've radio tracked leopard cats in the Phnom Penh affected forest, and they did extremely well. I think that our protocols on small carnivores work pretty well, and we release civets and leopard cats and that kind of thing. But there are other ways of monitoring them. You put camera traps to see what animals are taking the food that you are putting down for them after you've released them. And actual visual observation. So you see the animals are still around, you know, they can't take the food you're providing, or they're still within the forest, because you're present in the forest. So you know what's going on. So yes, monitoring of different kinds is essential. And you know, we have really amazing success at some of our rehab processes. Water birds, born at bred at Phnom Penh, we take them out of the aviary, we clip their wings and put them in a big lakeside area where we continue to feed them. These are spot-billed pelicans and painted storks largely, but also lesser adjutants. And we clip their wings when we take them out of the enclosure and continue to feed them in this lakeside area. And as wing feathers grow, the pelicans and the spot-billed pelicans and the painted storks follow normal migratory patterns and go fly off to their breeding ground, returning around 6 months later with fledged young. So, you know, and numbers have grown of these birds since I've been here, because I put, when they're in the non-breeding season, when they come from Phnom Penh, numbers have risen, and I put down extra food for them as they come back. So yeah, of course, monitoring is essential. If you don't monitor the animals that you release, you're merely throwing them away. And some animals don't need to be, you know, they come directly from the wild. They're, you know, spotted doves that have just had their wings clipped, so they can't fly. We just wait for wing feathers to grow, and then we open the cage door. And sure, we put down food for them, but there's no great monitoring needed. And it would be extremely expensive, because they would get hundreds and hundreds of doves in. But we feed them when we open the cage door to make sure that the transition isn't to a new area isn't too difficult.
Has there been any problem with releasing animals in an area where, genetically they're not from?
Actually, we wouldn't do that. Of course, the introduction of alien species has caused huge damage to indigenous wildlife for centuries. I mean, or certainly this century and last century. We have to ensure that animals that we release are from that area. So, for example, I mean, there is an example of gibbons. There are two species of gibbons in Cambodia, the pileated gibbon and the yellow-cheeked gibbon. And the river Mekong is the dividing line, with pileated in the west and yellow-cheeked in the east. And we wouldn't release pileated gibbons east of the Mekong. So, yeah, we have to be careful about that. And, you know, word of mouth, and there's no great research being done over the years in Cambodia. But word of mouth as to what is or was around is relevant.
Can you tell me about some of the animals that you have rescued?
Who has stood out in your mind?
We get some real stars, I guess you'd say. And I guess the biggest stars, I guess, in more ways than one, are the elephants. Little Chook, a young male elephant calf, found in up in the northeast of the country, in Mondulkiri, about 3 years ago now, maybe a little more than 3 years ago now. We were requested to go and sort the situation out. He was a tiny baby. He'd lost his foot to a snare. He'd lost a foot to a snare, and he was in really bad condition. Basically, snares constrict the blood flow, so that if an animal is in a snare for a very short period of time, it will lose the bottom part of the limb that is snared. And we have several three-legged animals that numb them out, and Chook's one of them. So that the foot looks perfectly healthy for a while, but then slowly disintegrates. We went up to Mondulkiri to assess the situation, myself and Nimti, the Forestry Administration vet that was working with me at the time. We saw that there was drastic intervention needed. I stayed in Mondulkiri with Chook in the forest, slept with him or close to him, hand-fed him everything he ate because he was extremely wild, and I knew that we would ultimately have to transport him to Nansa now, and he would need to be calm for that process. He was a wild baby elephant.
And did he let you get near him at first? How did you acclimate him to your presence?
He was tied to a tree by a rope around his neck. He was restrained. He needed care, he needed treatment, the foot needed veterinary attention. He was in a very bad way. He was incredibly thin. He should have been with his mother, he should have been suckling. And it was only his fighting spirit that was keeping him going, I think. So I was able to hand feed him and calm him down sufficiently for him to accept our presence, to stop trying to attack, even though he was tiny, to stop trying to attack everyone that went near him. And sure enough, the direction from the Director General of the Forestry Administration came that we should transport him to Phnom Penh, which we did. Nimti, myself, and the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team came to act as extra hands if needed, and security en route. I travelled with Chook on the back of the truck. We created a padded cage with banana trees and branches in the back of our truck. And I travelled in the back with him, hand feeding him as we went. And it was a very traumatic journey, which went actually extremely well. And we got him to Phnom Penh. Over time, his leg healed, but of course we couldn't regrow his foot. And so we had to think about what we would do next. I contacted many prosthetics organizations in Cambodia, because there is obviously a landmine problem and there has been a need for false limbs in the country. I ultimately contacted Kathy McConnell of the Cambodian School of Prosthetics and Orthotics, assisted, which is under the auspices of the Cambodia Trust. And Kathy said, yes, we'll try and help you. We can't guarantee success, but we'll do our best, which actually is more than anybody, any of the other organizations.
And usually she dealt with human prosthetics.
Yes, of course. Yeah, no elephant. Chuk's the first elephant in Cambodia with a prosthetic.
So a prosthetic leg had to be designed specifically for Chuk.
Yeah.
Had that ever been done before?
It had been done before, but we were kind of refused help by the people that had done it before. It's been done in Thailand a couple of times. So basically, we were working alone. There was a refusal to actually give too much assistance from this other organization in Thailand, which didn't matter because we were going to do it anyway.
How did you design a prosthetic, and how long would they last, and how did Chuk accept having that fitted for him?
Well, exactly, you know, and it was all a worrying, you know, a big worry, big problems. And often, actually, the biggest problems, like the rescue of Sambo, like the rescue of Chuk and fitting him with a prosthesis, often the biggest problems that worry you most in your mind turn out to be the smallest problem. CSPO, they're very professional. They know what they need to do. An elephant presented a challenge that they were, you know, I think really in retrospect, comfortably equipped to tackle. We obviously all got together and what we needed and the plan was made. They created the prosthesis, which is basically, you know, a few inches of, I guess it's plastic substance, under Chuk's foot, or under Chuk's leg, to take the place of a foot. And then in the bottom of a boot that's strapped onto his leg. And it's not complicated, and it's durable, but soft enough for it to cause him no discomfort. We fitted the first shoe, wondering how he would accept this new limb, because people that have prostheses take a while to understand what they've got and to actually come to terms with the attachment. And what would an elephant do? And that actually, the truth is, as happy as Larry, he was off in the forest. We take our elephants for walks in the forest every day, twice a day. And he was off in the forest. It was like he had it all his life. It wasn't a concern at all.
Really? No real adjustment required.
None at all. I think, you know, it made his life so much easier. He was obviously thinking he'd lost the bottom, I guess, around 6 inches of his leg. And he was hobbling. He used to sleep a lot because he used to get tired. He was obviously in a certain amount of discomfort. And this on the bottom of his foot, I guess he thought, well, God, that's easier, and he got on with it. He's a little boy too, so there's, you know, boys are different to girls, aren't they? There's no huge psychology to boys.
And how old is he now?
He's over 5 years old now, and he's got tusks, and he's becoming a male elephant. He is now becoming more difficult to handle. He's had whacks at his keepers, and, you know, people that come close to him. He's not so easy to handle now. And we could stop this with brutality, but we're not going to do that, of course. And what we need now is a new enclosure for him, so that I'm afraid his walks in the forest will stop with another of our elephants that's been adopted as Big Sister, Lucky, wonderful elephant. She's a young herself. She's about 11 years old herself, but she loves Chuk. She looks after Chuk, protects Chuk, and they walk in the forest together each day. These walks will have to stop for the safety of visitors at Nong Tamau and my keepers that I have a responsibility towards also. So we need the money to build a new enclosure for Chuk, which hopefully we will do this year.
Is that normal that elephants, as they get into their teen years, they become more aggressive?
In captivity, yes. And it would, in a normal zoo, it would probably be hands off too right now, because of yeah, I guess maturity beginning to kick in. Again, countries that actually work elephants, it's a different matter, and elephants are starved and beaten into submission, and then if we did that, too would be handleable. Would still be dangerous, but would be handleable. Now, of course, the difference with Chook and other elephants in captivity, male elephants in captivity, is we must handle Chook all his life because we need to adjust prosthetic limbs. We need to put them on and take them off every day, and therefore we're going to have to handle him all his life for his own development and his own comfort. So what we've done now is we have trained Chook using modern, even dog training methods, so that there is no violence to the training. It's only based on reward. Other people, countries do it with marine mammals, they do it with dogs, they do it with elephants. And we've trained Chook now to obey certain commands based on a reward. There's no violence. If he doesn't want to learn, he just walks away, and that's the end of it. It's from behind a protected area or a relatively safe area, so that we're not actually in the enclosure with him training him. We're outside, and we use it. It's target training. We get to come, and he will be rewarded. And then bit by bit, you develop that to presenting limbs, to coming close, so that we can inspect his body. Things like that. And Chook is now trained to give us his legs, and so we can, from the an area of safety, we can attach or detach the prosthetic foot, so that we will be able to actually create the next prosthesis from outside the enclosure, rather than one of the keepers, one side of him, me the other side, feeding him bananas. Keep him quiet while they sort the next cast of his foot out. It'll be done differently the next time.
Oh, interesting. So to get the new prosthesis, you need to cast his foot every few years, or how often does he need a new one?
I think it'll work out around twice a year. A, because Chook's growing, and B, because elephants are kind of heavy on footwear.
I would imagine.
And it looks new for about a week, and then it looks a bit battered and the straps putting it on. Come on, that doesn't matter too much. Yeah, we go through and we keep the Cambodian School of Prosthetics and Orthotics busy.
Now, are most of the animals rescued babies, or I know Sampo was a much older adult male. Is that right?
Yes, Sambo is a different matter altogether. And like I say, we deal with everything. If there's an animal problem, it's us that will get called in to do the whatever work is needed. Sambo was in more ways than one, was a mega problem. I tried to take a weekend off, which never ever happened. And
you must know that when you try to do that, that's when it's going to really, all come pouring down.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you hope a problem will go, like I hope Chook was a problem that would go away, somehow disappear, and it didn't. So we had to deal with it, and we did. Sambo again. He was, basically what happened was he was running loose. He was a domestic elephant, an adult, a huge adult domestic bull elephant. He killed a minimum of four people recently, and I've heard maybe seven or eight. His owners and people that looked after him were dead. His various people that had somehow gotten his way were also dead. And he was running loose in villages in the province of Kompong Spu, in near, not too far from Phnom Penh. And what happened was the forestry administration initially contacted me and said, would we help? And I wanted it clearly understood that it was the forestry administration's responsibility, so that we were not, if people got killed during the process of rescue or whatever we had to do, we would not be held liable, which might have been kind of unnecessary to do, because we'd get through the problems anyway, and if people were killed, you know, I guess that'd be life, but or not. But it needed to be understood that it, animals in Cambodia, no matter what we're doing to help them, and we, you know, fund all the care of the elephants, for example, ourselves, they still come down to the Forestry Administration, Cambodian Forestry Administration's responsibility. And they remind us of this frequently. So I was reminding the Cambodian Forestry Administration that this, that Sambo was basically their responsibility. And so that was accepted, and I said, look, it's our job here. You know, while we're not, just because a problem is difficult, we're not going to run away from it. We're going to deal with our what we consider our responsibilities, I said, of course, we'll help. It's the biggest problem really is financial. And immediately, two organizations in America, SeaWorld Busch Gardens and Disney Worldwide Conservation Fund, immediately helped us financially with the, so that we could implement the rescue. And my great thanks to them.
Now, the rescue was quite difficult because you had to confine him and then transport him.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, how the hell do we do all this?
Right. How did you?
And in the meantime, what happened was another organization in Mondulkiri, M-E-L-I-E, Elephants Livelihood Initiative Environment or something like that, up in Mondulkiri, became involved and run by a guy called Jack Highwood, and he felt that he could maybe take Sambo to his facility up in Mondulkiri. As soon as he saw Sambo, he came down and became involved, and the first thing he said, he said they didn't need me or us, Wildlife Alliance. And then as soon as Jack saw Sambo in full, you know, action, and said, I don't want that elephant. And he called me and he said, my God, I don't want that elephant. And Nick, you don't either. I knew that if he didn't want it, well, I then met with the Forestry Administration again, and Ratna Pitt said, yeah, there are three alternatives. One is Jack Highwood up in Mondulkiri. The other is Phnom Kamau Wildlife Rescue Center. And a lot of people have also been saying that the elephant should be killed. And I said, yeah, well, that is not an option. And I felt, actually, in the credit for Cambodian Forestry Administration, it wasn't an option for them either. And it certainly isn't an option for me. You know, for Wildlife Alliance, that's not even to be considered. So again, I worked with Minty, a very capable Forestry Administration vet. What happened was Jack and his mahouts stayed in Kompong Spoon, keeping local villagers under control, trying to ensure that the elephant wasn't molested or didn't, whatever. He couldn't get close. He was, actually, he was in mus, which is a condition male elephants come into. It may be sexually related, in which they're extremely, secretion comes from their temporal glands on their heads, and they're extremely dangerous. So basically Jack's job was to keep people away. Minty and I went up to Kompong Spoon, to the villages, and we sedated him and chained him, administered a standing sedation, chained him up and tethered him to the ground, and left Phnom Penh to make preparations for his arrival at Phnom Kamau. Jack stayed with Sambo. He and his guys fed him and kept him protected, along with local authorities, kept people away. Obviously, he was captured now and could have been at the mercy of local people, who actually were really good. Really, they were pretty good. Minty and I returned after we captured Sambo, returned to Phnom Penh to get a transport crate constructed, to hire a truck, and to prepare facilities at Phnom Tamau. We decided that he could be kept within our existing, on a temporary basis, within our existing elephant facilities, but it inconveniences our girls a little bit. We have a big outside enclosure, and that's where we thought Sambo could go, which needed reinforcing, which we did. We created a crate, which was probably ultimately weighing between 2.5 and 3 tons, that could hold this massive elephant. And we hired a crane, a flatbed truck with a crane, with an 8-ton crane with an 8-ton braking strain. And on December the 25th, we left once again, having paid a visit in the interim. We went back to Kampong Stu to capture him and again and transport him, get him into the crate and transport him to Phnom Tamau. The Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team came too, purely for crowd control purposes, and I have to say they did an absolutely fantastic job. People were completely contained. There was not an issue. A masterful job. Thousands of people came to watch. Yeah, it was quite a job.
Are there videos on YouTube that people can see?
It's written up on our website. The actual the transport to Phnom Tamau is written up on our website,
which is wildlifealliance.org.
Yeah, www.wildlifealliance.org.
Okay.
And what happened was Minty administered another sedation of Sambo. We got the truck, the cage, the transport cage, offloaded close to where we had Sambo tethered. We got the truck close by, and we managed to persuade Sambo to walk into the transport cage. And that all sounds extremely easy, and it wasn't. Sambo was in a paddy field, and of course getting an 8-ton or a huge whatever tower, it's a 16-wheeler truck into a paddy field is not easy. It sank down to its axles many times before we got it to the elephant. And Minty actually wanted to lift Sambo into the crate by using the crane. And I didn't want to do this. I felt an animal of Sambo's weight would be damaged if we did that. I didn't want to risk this. And I wanted to walk him into the crate, which we attempted to do. We had a digger, I don't know if you know, a JCB digger tractor with an arm and a bucket.
Okay.
Which we needed to extricate the truck from the mud. And we attached ropes to Sambo around his back end. And the digger driver was masterful. He gently, with our assistance of pushing and coaxing, he gently, I'd almost say not more than, grab would be too strong a word, coaxed Sambo into, with a little bit of pressure, into the transport crate. And Minty thought it couldn't be done, and I felt this method had to be our first option. And it worked actually surprisingly easily. We captured elephants before, and I tried to get them to walk into the crate, and they were too far away from where we were going to, where we wanted to, where we were able to load them. And maybe they fell over, and we had to revive them and go through the process again. With Sambo, he walked into the crate, was close enough, he walked into the crate, and that was the first part of the job successfully completed. The next part of the job was to lift the crate onto the truck, and which after many, many false starts, it finally got to Sambo. Sambo weighed between maybe 4.5 to 5 tons, and the crate weighed maybe 2.5 to 3 tons, and the braking strain of the crane was 8 tons. So we were kind of pushing the limit. And actually, again, me not a worry. Got him on the truck, no problem. Then getting the truck out of the paddy field with the bigger tractor in front and a bulldozer behind. We managed to do that. And then it was kind of dark on Christmas Day, and we were on the road and headed for Phnom Tamaugh. I travelled on the back, as I always do with animals that we rescue, just to make sure that if there is a problem, we can deal with it quickly. There was no problem on the back of us. We were on the road. Sambo was still sedated, still under the influence of the drugs we've given him. It's a standing sedation we give for elephants. So we don't want him down. We don't want him to lie down. And we stood the whole way. The drivers of the bulldozer, the lorry, and the JCB digger were absolutely fantastic. Any rapid jerks and movements might have shaken Sambo off his feet. And getting him out of that paddy field was a worry. They were so good. There were no kind of jerky movements or anything. Sambo stood the whole way, and it was fantastic. Absolutely great. Along the road, again, the same thing. It was dark. I was on the back of the truck, watching Sambo, really kind of the elation that I was feeling at quiet, just quiet happiness inside. It made up, there was no discomfort with what I was, the pleasure I was feeling, having done this job so far, so well.
And how long was the drive?
It wasn't that long. I don't know, really, I guess. In theory, without the elephant, it would have been months, an hour, no more than an hour, really. But with the elephant, maybe it was about 3 or 4. I can't remember, really. And we got to Phnom Tamaugh, I guess it must have been around 11-ish or 10-ish. I can't remember. And then we offloaded him to our paddock, opened the door of the transport crate. Minty administered the revival agents after we'd unchained him from the crate. His legs were chained to the crate to stop him moving around too much inside. And he walked off into the into his enclosure, into the dark. No problems at all. And we made it back to our beds around midnight on the 25th.
And how is he doing now?
Absolutely fantastic. We've still got he's still in musk, which means he's still dangerous. We've still got his front legs chained together because, again, it's not only Sambo we've got to think of. We've got to think of the safety of visitors to Phnom Tamaugh and the people that are looking after him and every other aspect, and safety to himself, actually. Because, as I say, the other option for him was death. If he carried on doing what he was doing up in Kompong Skru, the government, I don't think, could have sanctioned that he continued to survive, because he was killing people, and people would have taken the law into their own hands. So we have to protect him and everybody around. So he's still got his front legs chained together, but he can walk. He's eating. He's happy. He's actually amazingly peaceful, amazingly tranquil. He's happy where he is. He's in the company of our other elephants. He isn't in the enclosure with them, but he has contact with them, trunk contact, and they kind of communicate with each other. They go and meet each other. There's no violence ever from Sambo towards the girls. And the girls have developed a new, little friskiness in their step at the side of this handsome guy. The only problem that we've had actually has been when motorbikes go past his enclosure, which we've had to stop. For some reason, he's irritated him. They were of no influence. They wouldn't get near him, but they'd drive past his enclosure and he would charge. As his front legs are chained together, he had to gallop like a horse, but he can get up quite some speed like this. And it's quite impressive to see such a huge animal doing it. And he charged at the gate at the bottom, a steel gate at the bottom. He bent rather seriously in his attempt to get these motorbikes. And we've had to, that ceases to be a gate now. We've had to reinforce that, and we don't have it anymore. But that doesn't matter either. We fenced the area off so people can't ride their bikes in the area that was a problem. And that, so hopefully that problem has been now contained. And again, the other little worry that we had, we was Chook, another male elephant, so a very, very small one at the moment. We wouldn't let them have the two animals, the two bulls have contact with each other for fear that Sambo might damage Chook, might, for whatever reason. Better safe than sorry. But last Sunday, we thought that it was worth seeing what would happen. And, we encouraged distance contact with Chook on a chain from a distance so that they could get a little bit close and sniff each other, but couldn't actually wrap their trunks around each other or anything like that. And on Sunday, we let Chook get closer to Sambo. Game with the fence still in between, but it's not a complete barrier. And again, we need not have worried. Sambo was, he just couldn't have been sweeter and more gentle. We checked Chook out with his trunk and then laid a huge protected trunk along Chook's back. And it was absolutely, it was, you get moments of real kind of pleasure, real peace, inner peace, if you like. And that was one of them, to see Sambo being so gentle with this injured young elephant. And it makes you realize how maybe we got it wrong most of the time.
If people want to learn more or want to help, what can they do or where can they go?
They can visit our website. They can www.wildlifealliance.org. And Sambo's Rescue is written up. They can visit Mum to Mau Wildlife Rescue Center and they can see Sambo for himself. They can, if they're particularly concerned, again, we're kind of run our wildlife rescues and care on shoestring. It's incredibly expensive to do what we do. It's made more expensive by sudden arrival of this monster animal who actually deserves every chance he's getting.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks very much for calling. Thanks very much for talking to me. And it's been great. Nice to tell you about what we do.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about protecting wildlife in Cambodia with Wildlife Alliance's Nick Marks, Wildlife Rescue Director at the Phnom Tamau Wildlife Rescue Center in Cambodia and also advisor to the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team there.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the Animal Wise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.